Welcome to Influence, a podcast by Creative Writing at the University of Glasgow. I'm Sophie Collins.
I'm Colin Hurd. This episode's guest is Lisa Robertson. Her influence, Gina Barnes Knightwood.
Her flesh was the texture of plant life, and beneath it one sensed a frame, broad, porous, and sleep-worn, as if sleep were a decay fishing her beneath the visible surface.
Before we hear from Lisa, though, I'm curious, Colin, what does the word influence mean to you?
Well, I'm interested in influence as intoxication. You know that feeling of coming under something's spell or gliding on its wake like water skiing? I'm less interested in influence in terms of influencer culture, where influence is a sales tactic, although I definitely think that goes on in books too. When we started planning this podcast, I was reminded of John Cassavetes' 1974 film A Woman Under the Influence, where the Gina Rowlands character starts acting in a way that those around her deem strange, but which is actually just subverting societal expectations. So I'm intrigued about whether influential texts are influential on us because they disrupt or unbind us from other influences. Also, what are the differences between being under the influence, influenced by, and influence as etymologically in the flux of something?
I like those ideas because I think, personally, that encountering a book that grabs you can be intoxicating or disruptive in the way of a love affair. And as in love, we also become possessive, jealously guarding the books, ideas, or artifacts that influence us. We often wish to sort of become unique in our association to that thing, which is, of course, impossible, as in love. Also appealing to me is the idea that influences could be retroactive, that they might be acting on us from some point in the future. So I fully believe in time as a flat circle. Have you ever had that feeling of encountering something which feels as though it was written by you or is so close to something you've already written that you think you must have read it before, only you definitely haven't?
A recent guest to our Creative Conversations series, Lisa Robertson is the author of many books, all with fantastic titles, including Debbie and Epic, The Weather, Lisa Robertson's Magenta Soul Whip, and Nilling, Essays on Noise, Pornography, The Codex, Melancholy, Lucretius, Fold, Cities, and Related Aporias. The Baudelaire Fractal, a novel, is her most recent book. It was published last year. We're particularly thrilled to welcome Lisa as our first guest on Influence, because her work is not only exceptionally influential on contemporary experimental writers, but also exquisitely attuned to the intensities of literary influence.
Lisa's influence, Knightwood, was published in the UK in 1936. It has notable admirers and influencees in its editor, T.S. Eliot, who first published the book through Faber and Faber, as well as Jeanette Winterson, who introduces the new edition. Eliot wrote a preface to the book on its first American publication in 1937, in which he speaks about the act of reading and, obliquely, this idea of influence, raising concerns about the intimacy one develops with a book, his words, and the way that writing such a preface might suppose that all readers will draw from that book all that one has come to perceive. He says further that Knightwood is a book in which readers will find the great achievement of a style, the beauty of phrasing, the brilliance of wit and characterization, and a quality of horror and doom very nearly related to that of Elizabethan tragedy. Winterson's introduction to the 2007 paperback is enraptured. She speaks about the different ways one might experience it on first, second, third readings, saying that reading Knightwood is like drinking wine with a pearl dissolving in the glass. You've taken in more than you know, and it will go on doing its work. From now on, a part of you is pearl-lined.
Hi, Lisa.
Glad to be here speaking with you.
Yeah, we're so pleased to have you. So to begin us, for those who are not familiar with Barnes and her work, could you please introduce her to our listeners?
Sure. Gina Barnes was an American writer born in 1892 in Cornwall on Hudson in New York State, USA, and died in 1982 as obviously an extremely elderly lady in Greenwich Village in New York, where she spent the last almost 50 years of her life in one apartment. She, as a very young woman, was a reporter, a magazine writer, and an illustrator for magazines. This was a time before photography was typical in mass market publications. In New York City, she wrote on the theater. She did a lot of interviews. She interviewed famously Charlie Chaplin, even. And her work as a reporter took her to Europe from time to time. And she decided that she would have more freedom to write her real work, that is her literary work, as opposed to the money jobs as a reporter, if she were to live in Berlin or Paris, where it was much cheaper. Many experimental women writers were doing the same thing at the same time. Gertrude Stein, H.D., the bookseller Sylvia Beach, who opened Shakespeare & Company bookstore in Paris. I could go on. The difference with Barnes is that she had no personal wealth whatsoever. She didn't have a tidy little sum of money to set herself up. So she depended totally on her freelance journalism work to support her. And that dried up with the stock crash in 1929. So from 1929, she basically lived off of donations from friends, who included often Samuel Beckett and regularly Peggy Guggenheim. She decided to settle in Paris. She began publishing there in 1928. She published a novel called Rider, which was on the bestseller list, but then ultimately economically failed because of the stock market crash, which bottomed out the literary market for everybody. And she also published in that time Ladies' Almanac, and she had previously published in New York City a charming little pamphlet of verses and lugubrious drawings of women's bodies called The Book of Repulsive Women. That came out in 1913. And that book was actually my introduction to Barnes. I saw a copy of it in Shakespeare and Company in about 1984, where George Whitman, the then owner, actually had the copy which Juno Barnes had given to Sylvia Beach. So I was kind of initiated a little bit into that cult of radical expatriate Anglophone writers in Paris by that little book, The Book of Repulsive Women. But it wasn't until a few years later that I read Nightwood. It's an extremely non-normative text. It was then, it is now. But not more so than James Joyce's work, for example, with whom she's often been compared or accompanied by critically. The text itself she wrote between perhaps 1927 and 1935. It went through multiple drafts. Evidently, the first finished draft was well over 600 pages long. So in the rewriting process and the editing process, this book lost 400 pages, just saying. In terms of plot, what is it? It's a story of difficult, jealous, failed love between two lesbian lovers, Nora and Robin. This core love story. Robin is a philanderer, and she goes out at night and leaves Nora at home to suffer. And then eventually she leaves Nora for another woman who really is not her equal, Jenny, who's represented as a sort of piffling, petty person who just likes to feed off of other people's love. So there are those two love stories, and there is the story of Robin's early marriage to a man named Felix von Wolkbein, a marriage which produces one son before Robin flees. Then there is an overarching superstructure which holds these various love stories and losses together, which is the very omnipresent voice of the transvestite doctor, Dr. Matthew O'Connor, who is an American from San Francisco, has made his way to Paris to, quote, study medicine, represents himself as a gynecologist, and he is like a father, mother, really, mother confessor to all of the characters in the book. They all pour out their griefs upon him. He has these intense and dense soliloquies in which he expounds upon his observations and theories about queer love, about time, and about the night. It's his wild voice that really holds these various stories together.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for tracing the histories of Knightwood as a book and contextualizing it in the particular modernist milieu, as you've done so brilliantly there. I think you've selected an excerpt from Knightwood to read to us, and it would be wonderful if you could do that now.
Now, this is our introduction to Robin. We are seeing her through the eyes of Felix. This is Felix laying his gaze upon Robin for the first time. I say upon because she is recumbent, as you will hear. And Felix is accompanying Dr. Matthew, who has been called to Robin's hotel room by the hotel porter because she is passed out. On the second landing of the hotel, it was one of those middle-class hostelries which can be found in almost any corner of Paris, neither good nor bad, but so typical that it might have been moved every night and not have been out of place. A door was standing open, exposing a red-carpeted floor, and at the further end, two narrow windows overlooking the square. On a bed, surrounded by a confusion of potted plants, exotic palms, and cut flowers, faintly oversung by the notes of unseen birds, which seemed to have been forgotten, left without the usual silence and cover, which, like cloaks on funeral urns, are cast over their cages at night by good housewives, half flung off the support of the cushions from which, in a moment of threatened consciousness, she had turned her head, lay the young woman, heavy and disheveled. Her legs, in white flannel trousers, were spread as in a dance, the thick lacquered pumps looking too lively for the arrested step. Her hands, long and beautiful, lay on either side of her face. The perfume that her body exhaled was of the quality of that earth flesh fungi, which smells of captured dampness, and yet is so dry, overcast with the odor of oil, of amber, which is an inner malady of the sea, making her seem as if she had invaded a sleep incautious and entire. Her flesh was the texture of plant life, and beneath it one sensed a frame, broad, porous, and sleep-worn, as if sleep were a decay fishing her beneath the visible surface. About her head there was an effulgence as of phosphorus glowing about the circumference of a body of water, as if her life lay through her in ungainly, luminous deteriorations, the troubling structure of the born somnambule who lives in two worlds, meat of child and desperado.
I love this idea that comes up there of that one might be able to enter sleep incautiously. And it also just occurred to me, hearing you read just then, that there are some parallels maybe between this and Marcel's descriptions of Albertine. In Proust, there's a sort of plant-like passivity of Robin, which is quite interesting. But why did you pick this particular excerpt, Lisa?
I love the way we approach the image of her body by means of plant life, of bird song, of fungal odor, of strange emanations of a phosphoric light. Basically, if one were to reduce this passage to its kind of simplest core of meaning, the sentence, the passage I read would be, a woman lay on a bed. This is the so-called information that we're receiving. So stylistically, what this incredible prose is showing us is that prose, in fact, is not informational, but prose has to do with the deeply mysterious structure of consciousness. And it has to do with the multiplicity of perception in time, the way we see things which perhaps could seem to be obvious. We see things by increments and in layers. It introduces one of the great problems, which is the problem of sleep and night. What are they? What is sleep? What is night?
I know that you're someone who is fundamentally interested in, activated and excited by the book or the codex as an object and as a technology. After reading Nilling a few years ago, I will never not open a book and think the word skirty murmur to myself as I do so. The Baudelaire Fractal is also a book about reading. Early on in the novel, you've written, another style of consciousness inflects one's own, an odd syntactic manner, a texture of embellishment, pause, a new mode of rest. I can feel physiologically haunted by a style, as if seized by a fateful kinship. Against all the odds of sociology, the reader psychically assumes the cadence of the text. She sheds herself. So I know you've already answered this to some extent, but is this one book with which you feel such a kinship? And please tell us a bit more about the first time you encountered Nightwood.
I have to say that in my first reading of Nightwood, my first relationship, my introduction to this text, I was not at all seized. I was frustrated, confused, troubled. I think that I would have to say that over decades, I've been subtly seduced by this text. The situation of my entry into Nightwood as one of its readers was in my mid-20s. I guess I was 26, maybe 27. I was part of a reading group in Vancouver, a feminist reading group. And the other women who were part of this group, which was called the Vultures, were older than I was and much more intellectually and culturally sophisticated. And I felt a lot of trepidation and excitement around them. One was a painter, one was a feminist film theorist. One, Miriam Nichol, became the main editor and biographer of the poet Robin Blazer. So these women told me, you must read Nightwood. I knew about Juna Barnes because, as I said, I had come across the book of Repulsive Women during an early sojourn in Paris. And I had read this remarkable book by Sherry Benstock called Women of the Left Bank, Paris 1900 to 1940, which came out in 1986, 87, the same time I was in that reading group. And this was like core text to so many of us. So I knew about Barnes. I knew about her mystique, her presence in Paris. I actually had a friend in Paris who told me about Barnes because she knew one of Barnes's critics, and this friend, whose name was Minou, who always wore a bowler hat and liked to do things like hunt for angels among the architectural ornament of old buildings in the Marais. She presented herself as a Barnesian figure in her sweeping cloaks and interesting headgear. So I was ready to adore Barnes for all those reasons. And I was stumped when I got hold of the book obediently and began to read. They had suggested it because I was going through a really vicious, long, long, long breakup. You know, somebody who I was with for 7 years probably, but had been breaking up with for probably five of them, one of those. So that's why they suggested this to me, because I was, you know, troubled, to put it mildly. So I read the book and I thought, oh my God, do they just want me to kill myself? This is the most depressing book I've ever read. And, you know, I guess I was hunting for some clues on, you know, how to survive alive. And of course, that's not what you're going to find in Nightwood. What you're going to find is an increasingly complex description of the problem with no solutions. And what's the problem? It's the ever-changing relationship of life to love, the relationship of time to Eros. So once I re-entered Nightwood at the level of the sentence, it started yielding and becoming juicy. So since then, it's been a gradual deepening lifelong love.
That's so fascinating to hear. My first reading of Nightwood was as a, I think, 19 or 20-year-old. And I think you're right that in spite of that dark, twistedness, depressive qualities that the book has, it also, you know, your word juicy, it really has a juiciness too. I was really struck by Nightwood's queerness. I mean, there are so many thrillingly outre moments, like when the doctor is giving a kind of gourmet's appreciation in answer to his own self-question, and do I know my sodomites? But also in the arrangements of the characters around each other, the unconventional orientations that resist the nuclear family. There's also this moment when Dr. Matthew rails against a bar. What people? All queer in a terrible way. There were some queer good people, but none of you will ever know them. Well, part the diamonds and you'll find slugs meat. I guess I just want to hear whether part of the attraction of Nightwood for you was its queerness.
Well, as far as I know, in the 80s, queerness was not so much a current term. So I did not think in terms of this marvelous noun that we have access to now. To me, this was a lesbian text. In that sense, it was in conversation with a whole milieu of other lesbian texts. I had already been reading Gertrude Stein for a long time. I had been reading Natalie Barnes, HD's long-term lover, Breyer. Breyer was a novelist, among other things, a publisher of a critical film journal. So I saw Barnes as part of this marvelous lesbian tradition of modernism. It was really a point of great interest to me that most of the modernist texts by women were by lesbian women. What I also want to say about Nightwood's queerness is that for me, the question of queerness goes beyond the very important fact and identity experience of sexual desire and which bodies one desires when and how. Nightwood takes me into a queering of the sentence, for example, a queering of narrative. And it also reveals to me repeatedly the necessity of this queering, which I will sort of define as a multiplicity of focal points, unlike a classical geometrical figure, which has one focal point and one line of narrative. This book has many focal points and many intersplicing and layered timelines within it. This book queers time itself, the relationship of the body to time, the relationship of language and narrative to time. So that queering, to me, is really necessary. It was necessary then. This period of the writing and early publication of Nightwood was, of course, the same period as the rise of fascism in Europe. It was as important then as unfortunately it remains now, as perhaps we are or have entered another area of at least a totalitarian seizure of culture and representation by a neoliberal machine.
I think that so much of what you've just said speaks to this next question that I have for you, which is about the style of Nightwood, which is so ornamental, so lush. Reading it, in fact, made me think back to one of your epigraphs to the Baudelaire fractal from Deleuze's Difference and Repetition, where he writes, "In this domain, as in Sartor Resartus, It is the masked, the disguised, or the costumed which turns out to be the truth of the uncovered. Could you maybe tell us a bit about your thoughts on literary ornamentation and truth and the relationship between those things and Nightwood and your own writing? I'm really interested in this idea that ornamentation might in fact be what reveals the truth rather than disguises it.
Yes. Well, to give myself a tiny bit of time to consider how I'm going to line up my answer, and also to treat you to another snippet of the text, I'll read you this little quote of Dr. Matthew. So Nora, when she first meets Dr. Matthew and Felix in a bar in Berlin, very early in the book, this is page 18 in my edition, so quite early, she hears Dr. Matthew ranting in a Berlin bar, and she says, "Are you both really saying what you mean, or are you just talking?" Now, of course, we could take that as a critique of Barnes's style per se, and I'm sure she heard snide remarks like that from many people. Pound, for one, thought that she was a terribly overrated author and should be kept in her place. And the doctor replies, "Nora suspects the cold, incautious melody of time crawling, but I've only just started." So there is this crawling quality to the style and the sentence. It's going nowhere slowly. But what I want to say about it, with all respect, is that I don't perceive her style as being ornamental. This is a term that is used by many, many of her critics, even very, very good critics. It is a term that a great deal of discourse around her work picks up and considers in different ways. For me, that part of the reason I'm less interested in the word ornamentation is because ornamentation seems to me to be an addition of something extra to a basic structure. Whereas the complexity that we're approaching in her sentences, such as this sentence I read at the beginning of our discussion, "on a bed surrounded by a confusion of potted plants," etc., it's a structure of deferral. The subject comes at the very end after this whole presentation of a nuance, of a mood, of the slipperiness of perceiving, of seeing, of understanding. For me, the structure of the sentence is a form of truth in the way that it crawlingly tracks the confusion of perception and of knowledge. In this text, knowledge is never attained, so the status of truth comes by means of a gradual grappling, a circling around, and an ongoing description. That's how I see the style working in relationship to what we might call an ethics, or at very least an epistemology of prose.
That's so fascinating, Lisa. There's also a lot in this book about history, legend, myth, and also cultural, or even in book's terms, racial memory. For example, there's a section where Dr. Matthew talks about legend being unexpurgated and history deflowered. And there's also this reflection on the inbreeding of pain. These explorations of memory and history occur in a novel that, as you've so brilliantly evoked, queers its temporalities. It's a novel full of aporia, a novel in which, for example, Guido is no sooner born than they're a fully fledged child. What do you think is going on with this layering of different concepts and senses of time?
I feel that it's very necessary to consider the historical context of the writing of this book and the historical period which the book is representing, basically the 1880s through till the late 1920s. This is the period of the institutionalization of anti-Semitism in its current manifestations in various European countries. The opening sentence of Nightwood is the birth of Felix. His mother is a Christian woman, a Viennese woman, who has married a Jewish man who has integrated himself into the mainstream of culture to the point that he passes himself off as being Christian. So at the very opening of the novel, we have the birth of a man of two origins, one of which has been repressed by his father, who dies, in fact, before he is born. So what Barnes is presenting is a kind of figure of anti-Semitism as it has historically unfolded in Europe to a life. And she's presenting a consideration of how that anti-Semitism structures culture and structures relationships. She was an American woman of a kind of radical Christian background. I think her father or her grandmother was Seventh-day Adventist, perhaps. She fled her family anyways, repudiated them quite thoroughly. Here she is going to Europe as an extremely sophisticated, very culturally involved young woman. And what does she see? You know, she is in Europe during the rise of anti-Semitism and seeing it in the people around her. So one of the ways to approach this multiplicity of time in the narrative is through a historical model, by saying that the history of Europe as a dominant narrative has become a history of Christianity as a totalizing institution and as a violently repressive institution. So the necessity of keeping timelines multiple has to do with the necessity of keeping an actual history of Europe, which is a history of multiple peoples, of Jewish people, of gay people, of Black people, of circus people. It has to do with keeping all those histories present simultaneously.
Yeah. In fact, there's just after the excerpt that you read us earlier, I think it's the Doctor who says, to pay homage to our past is the only gesture that includes the future.
Yes, 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 yes. And I think that's a message that we just need to hold so close to our hearts, but also so openly in the public as a reminder to all of us who are making cultural works of whatever form.
And just to stay on that question of race, just briefly, there's a lot of pathologizing and taxonomizing that goes on of different races on the part of the Doctor. And it's something of which Barnes is clearly aware of a facet of his character. So do we think that's all part of the sort of same argument of this idea of trying to think of a total history?
I do think so. I do think so. I think that an important thing to keep in mind when we're reading Dr. Matthew O'Connor's rants, which use extremely strong language in description of all marginal peoples and groups of people, all of those groups that I already named a few seconds ago, we have to think of his style in terms of a kind of a carnivalesque style, a Rabelaisian style, where cliché is almost exploded rather than avoided, so that the extremity of difference is not reduced to a kind of pedagogical nicety, but is presented as bodily difficulty.
Yeah, I love that sense of the carnivalesque in the novel. And one of the strata which that seems to play out is in the characters' names. A Flood and Vote and Felix. There's this incredible sort of play of intensity between the characters' names.
Yeah, yeah. And also the novel is based, by all accounts, it's based on Juno Barnes's love affair with Thelma Wood, which happened over 7 or 8 or 10 years, something like this. And of course, Wood is in the title, Nye T. Wood. So yes, all of the density of naming comes into play.
So in this podcast, we invited you to select one influential text, but we're also aware that influence is something that certainly isn't singular and it works in wild and weird and mysterious ways. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of influence for Juno Barnes and influences on Knightwood, but also influence the significance of influence for your own work? And if you had some backup choices that you considered before alighting on Knightwood?
Okay, lovely question, because influence is another one of those things that is so diverse and so complicated, and it's a big knot to return to unpick. Just to get my little bit out of the way so I can return to Barnes, my backup choices were two Canadians, Leonard Cohen, who I started listening to his albums and reading his novels before I read his poetry when I was a teenager, and Elizabeth Smart, the prose writer, and her novel, By Grand Central Station, I Sat Down and Wept, which came out in the 40s, so probably about, 10 years or so after Barnes, but like Barnes, was deeply influenced by 17th century English prose style. Elizabeth Smart, probably mostly by the 17th century King James translation of the Bible, where this has been a font of prose for many an atheist. In Barnes's case, her 17th century influences would include the Florio translation of Montaigne, Florio was the first English translator of Montaigne, who she cites in Knightwood. It would profoundly include Robert Burton and his book, The Anatomy of Melancholy. One of her early titles for Knightwood was The Anatomy of Night, in a sort of echoing of The Anatomy of Melancholy. The Anatomy of Melancholy is, of course, about the humoral system of psychology and medicine and cosmology. So it's about the circulation of humors in the body, in the psyche, and in the cosmos. Another instance of the juiciness we referred to earlier. I think I would have to say that it was Barnes who introduced me to 17th century English prose, which has since become one of my great passions.
Well, thank you, Lisa. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks for giving me the time. I've loved it.
Been listening to Influence. You can find more information about the podcast and forthcoming episodes on our Instagram page. Our handle is talking_influence. Our sound editor is Max Parnell, and our theme music is Really Really by Competition.
Information about Creative Conversations, our creative writing event series, can be found at glasgow.ac.uk/events/creative-conversations. Thanks for listening.